We have on the agenda today the testimony, invited testimony from John Tapania and John Marshall. I believe you folks are going to be introducing the Eco-Northwest study on K-12 education finance in Oregon. I think we'd just like to get into that. Steve, do you have any comments to begin with?
No.
Okay, I've already seen this once. They testified and presented this to the Revenue Options Task Force at our meeting in Bend, I guess it was. And it was a very interesting presentation, so I think you'll enjoy this, members, and I'll turn it over to them, and feel free to interrupt with questions as we go along.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, good morning. John Marshall with the Oregon School Boards Association. I'm sure many of you have observed through the course of the last several years that it doesn't seem that a week or a month goes by that there's not some kind of report in the press surrounding school district spending. And it seems as though each report that comes out shows a different number relative to Oregon spending compared to other states, Oregon's school district spending compared to other school districts. There are a variety of national concerns that prepare school finance data. The National Education Association, the National Center for Education Statistics. There was recently a report out from the Cascade Policy Institute here in Oregon. Given the variety of these reports and the fact that the numbers seem to all differ, we wanted to get a handle on exactly what the facts were. So we retained the services of Eco-Northwest, a very reputable and well-known economic consulting firm in Portland, to prepare a study. And the study is really in three parts. The first part is to take a look at these national studies that compare Oregon school district spending with other states and to try to get a handle on the numbers and why they're different. The second part of the study was to take a look at Oregon school district spending since Measure 5 passed. And answer simply the question, where's the money gone? And so that's one of the results of the study. And finally, we wanted to look at some sample school districts. And we selected 16 school districts. And those were selected based on geographic diversity, size of school district, and districts that fared differently under Measure 5 and the equalization that followed. So to present the reports of that study is John Tapania, an economist with Eco-Northwest. I believe you all have copies of the study. So with that, we'll let him get into that.
Welcome. Good to see you again, John. Please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. Again, my name is John Tapania. I'm with Eco-Northwest. It's a Eugene-based economic consulting firm with offices in Portland and Seattle. We've done economic analysis in Oregon and Washington and increasingly so across the country since 1974. As John introduced this, this study was sort of born largely out of an April 2002 Oregonian article that reported that, according to the National Center on Education Statistics, that spending per student in Oregon was a little bit higher than the national average in 2001, was a little bit higher or was higher than California's, Washington's, and Idaho's in the most recent reporting. And if you had gone back 10 years and looked at the same statistics, you would have found the same conclusion, that it was a little bit higher than the national average, and it was higher than California, Washington's, and Idaho. So that raised a lot of questions because there certainly had been a lot of reports locally that school funding had not kept pace with inflation and that there was sort of a school funding crisis, that the schools were generally underfunded. And so the Oregon School Board Association came to us and said, look, there's a lot of different statistics out there. Our members throughout the state of Oregon do not understand sort of this conflicting evidence that's coming forward, so we'd like to clarify it. And so this was an attempt, and I hope a successful one, to clarify the statistics around school funding. As John mentioned, the study had three basic questions. First of all, looking at spending per student in Oregon, how is it calculated and how has it changed since roughly 1990-91 with the imposition of Measure 5 and the sort of the switch from a largely property tax financed, locally financed system to one that is more dependent on income taxes and state revenues. The second question is, how does Oregon's spending per student compare with that of other states? And can you even compare it to other states? That was sort of an open question when we started this, because there are some concerns that states don't report their spending per student in the same way and that you're not comparing apples to apples when you look across states. So we will address that as well. And then finally, recognizing that the process of equalization, which has been well publicized in the Oregonian articles in recent weeks, recognizing that that was taking place in the 1990s as well, the third question is, how has spending per student changed for 16 school districts, with OSBA understanding that depending on where you sit in this state, the 1990s could have looked considerably different. Starting first with the first question, spending per student, how is it calculated and how has it changed? Obviously, a spending per student figure has to have a numerator, the spending figure or a revenue figure at the top, and then a student figure at the bottom. And where a lot of the confusion is going to come is that there are multiple measures of spending or revenues on the top of that equation, and there are multiple measures for students as well. And the conclusion at the end of this presentation is that people mix and match those without telling you what they're giving you and get considerably different answers. So a brief summary here on those spending figures or the numerators. The first one that is quite common in this building is formula operating revenues. So that would be the amount that the state combines of both sort of state revenues, income tax, and lottery funds at the state level, together with locally raised monies through property taxes, and then distributes back to the districts through the funding formula. So that would be one number that people consider as a figure that we pay attention to, and how much are we spending per student, or how much are we generating in revenue for students. If you add to that grant programs that might be distributed by the state, the federal government, or even localities that they raise on their own, plus some child nutrition programs, you add that to the formula operating revenues, then you get something closer to what would be called nationally current expenditures, which are the operational and maintenance expenditures, or sort of the total amount that schools spend to keep schools running on a daily, monthly basis. So those are the ongoing sort of variable costs of the schools. Then if you add to the current expenditures major capital outlays for the expansion, the building of new schools, and the debt service on the interest to finance those new schools or expansions or remodelings, then you get to something known as total expenditures. So that would be the whole sort of the whole ball of wax. So three major definitions here, the first being the amount of money generated through the formula, the second one being sort of the total amount that keeps the schools running on a day-to-day basis, and then finally total expenditures being those operation expenditures plus the capital outlays to keep the buildings in shape. This chart shows the trends over the 1990s for those three streams, with the blue line at the bottom being the formula operating revenues, the sort of aqua line in the middle being the current expenditures, and then the burgundy line at the top being total expenditures, including the capital outlays, etc. You will see there's sort of increasingly a gap between the aqua line and the blue line as we move toward the end of the 90s. And that is a function of the fact that federal money's coming in the state, we're growing a little bit faster than the formula revenue, and so those federal monies are being used for those current expenditures. Also, at the beginning of this decade, there was very little in the way of local money that wasn't formula-related being spent. By the end of the decade, there was some, so that was growing over the period. Then also, around 1997, there were some state monies through lottery funds that sort of supplemented. It wasn't distributed through the formula, but was raised and spent through grants on the state. So that money was created in the late 1990s as well. Would be counted in current expenditures, but wouldn't be counted in the formula. So that's why you sort of see that slightly distancing of the aqua and the blue lines at the end of the decade. So those are the three sort of key expenditure or spending figures that are most frequently reported in Oregon. Now let's move to the bottom of the equation, which is the number of students, and there we also have a number of different measures. The first on the left is one that's I believe most frequently used in this building, which is the average daily membership weighted for the number of either special education students, ESL students, and the like. It is actually derived from the number that's in the third column over there, the average daily membership of residents in your district. So let's actually start with that third one. The average daily membership, if you looked over the course of the school year and counted up the number of students that were eligible to come to your school on an average basis over the course of the year, that would be the number that you would get, but you're only counting once for everybody. That number across the state of Oregon increased from about 462,000 in 1991 to 528,000 in 2002. So that increased by about 66,000 students over the course of the decade. Now, in essence, what happens with the weighting formula is that you take that statistic, average daily membership for residents, and then you take particular students, and for the purposes of the funding formula, you increase their weight. So special education students are multiplied by two. Students that are in households that are below the federal poverty line have a special weight. Students that are pregnant or teen pregnancy have a special weight. Kindergartners are actually weighted less than one. But most of the weights are obviously greater than one, and so that statistic obviously becomes larger than the average daily membership counted one student at a time. And if we look at that number, again, this is in the first column, that increases from about 533,000 in 1991 to 648,000 roughly in 2002. And the change, again, is important. That one has increased by 1,114. So some pretty strong growth there. Oops. In average daily membership. So two things going on there. There were more students being classified as special education students in need of special services. There was also a relatively strong growth in English learning students over the course of the decade throughout most of the Willamette Valley and other parts of Oregon as well. I've sort of skipped over two of those statistics. Fall enrollment first, which is in the second column. Fall enrollment is literally a head count typically taken on October 1st of the number of students that are eligible that are going to be enrolled in public schools, but it is at one point in time, typically again October 1st, and is not taken again over the course of the year. That number is fairly comparable with the average daily membership figure, starting at about 485,000, going up to 551,000, and the growth is almost identical for fall enrollment over the course of that decade. And the final number on the right-hand side is average daily attendance. And that figure started in 1991 at 432,000, went up to 482,000 for growth of about 51,000 over the course of the decade. Average daily attendance is, again, a statistic that is calculated over the course of the year, but that attempts to capture the number of students that are actually showing up for school on an average daily basis. So absences are captured in that figure. That figure, obviously, because there are going to be absences over the course of the year, is going to be the smallest of the student figures, because it's not counting a body if it doesn't happen to be in the school that day. And according to the National Center on Education Statistics, that figure on on average daily attendance is the one that has sort of the most measurement differences across states, that states can dictate to their departments of education different ways of counting average daily attendance, and therefore there's a little bit more variability when you're looking across states. And comparisons across states for that particular statistic are less reliable. Obviously, the two in the middle are the ones that the Center on Education Statistics would recommend if you are making comparisons between states. Those are the most reliable. And then finally, the average daily membership weighted, since no other state uses that statistic in precisely the same way that Oregon does, there is no way to use that to make comparisons on average daily membership weighted between Oregon and any other state.
Can I?
Yes, please.
Average daily membership for resident. You said it was the students who are eligible to attend in the district. Now, I suspect that's not really what you mean, but maybe it is. Does that include then the students who attend private schools who are in the district, students who are homeschooled, or some other number? Because they're eligible to attend, but they don't.
Right. I believe, and I do need to refresh my memory on this, but my understanding is that it would factor out students that are attending private schools and homeschooling, et cetera, that it would factor those students out, which would be consistent with the similarity in the two numbers between average daily membership and fall enrollment, which truly is the number of students that are sitting in the seats in the schools on October 1st.
One more final.
Yes.
Now, why then would the fall enrollment number be so much, would be larger? Than the average daily membership. If the average daily membership, I mean, I would assume that the average daily membership, obviously incorrectly assume, that average daily membership would include everybody who attended on October 1st plus a few more. And that's obviously wrong because the number's small.
No, well, fall enrollment would be a picture on October 1st of what happened. Now, average daily membership is multiple pictures at points in time over the course of the year. So if students moved out of the district, it's not an accumulative number of students that ever attended that district, but it's the average number of students that studied in that district over the course of the year. So if a student dropped out of school, they wouldn't be counted. If a student relocated out of the district, they wouldn't be counted in that figure.
Okay.
So think of it as one picture on October 1st versus multiple pictures over the course of the year for that same district.
All right. Last question, yeah. If I may. So a student who drops out, it may be eligible to attend, but because he's not attending, he's not included in this average daily membership.
That is my understanding.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Thompson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, thank you. On the fall enrollment figure, it seems to me that there could be some variances due to states that have high migrant populations. Is there any kind of is that factored in or recognized in any way?
We attempted to drill down some understanding on fall enrollment and how that might differ across states, and unfortunately didn't get any satisfactory answers. There was speculation, for example, even in Oregon, that because the weather is so nice in September and early October that some parents are still on vacation until, you know, the week after October 1st, and therefore Oregon might be a little bit different than the rest of the country. That was the only it's sort of almost an urban myth, but we didn't have any satisfactory answers on state-to-state differences in fall enrollment, only that the folks at the National Center on Education Statistics said, in their view, that was the most reliable since it is one point in time. But no one's no one's done a study to understand how states might count those students differently.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hobson, this may be more anecdotal than backed by data, but some evidence indicates that school districts that have high levels of migrant population tend to have higher enrollment after, as John suggests, the weather turns bad. There's obviously a lot of field activity, agricultural activity, and many parents keep their kids out of school to engage in those kinds of things, and then when the weather turns bad, they all of a sudden show up in school.
John, that would be true of other states, however, also, wouldn't it? For instance, strawberries are picked in the spring, and in Louisiana, you have the outgrow of kids that are kept home because they have to pick the berries.
Certainly, and I think, Representative Verger, that's the downside of picking a particular day. I mean, there would probably be differences if you picked November 1st or September 1st. It's just an anomaly that occurs by a particular day in counting bodies.
A follow-up. Yes. Sure. I guess that I would just ask that in looking at numbers, I mean, numbers are irrelevant, and they certainly have some meaning, but if I don't know really what's in those numbers, it's very difficult for me to understand. So I think that, back to Representative Barnhart's comment, are homeschoolers and private schools in this average daily attendance number? I think that's very important.
Well, I will certainly get back to the committee to precisely clarify those particular students. We do have in our report the official definitions that are forwarded by the U.S. Department of Education in their request to the state on how they report that. Ultimately, you need to speak with the person who fills out the form in the state of Oregon. The interesting thing is that that person also changes over time. So the particular person who is filling it out in, well, there are multiple people. There are 198 different people in the state of Oregon in different districts that are filling out fall enrollment statistics that are then reporting them to the state, and then one individual here who takes those reports and reports them to the federal government. And so inevitably, in a information collection exercise like that, there's going to be some variance in the way that even with the same instructions, different districts will report. But I will get back to the committee with more precise information about the treatment of those particular populations.
Well, John, looking at page 2-5 of the report with the definition there, resident average daily membership is defined as the year-to-date average of daily student enrollment for students residing within the district. So that does appear to address enrollment as opposed to just resident within the district but not enrolled. Okay. And the next sentence is, some resident students may attend a school in another district. Well, I guess the question is, then, are they counted in the host district, the resident district, or the attending district? But it does address enrollment anyway. It seems to anyway,
right.
Definition.
So, again, to summarize, with three, if you have three different spending figures as candidates in the numerator of the statistic and four candidates for the denominator, then you can wreak havoc as an analyst if you think about trying to formulate and understand a spending per student figure. So in this chart, we simply tried to illustrate the range of answers that you could get, all of them perfectly valid on spending per student in Oregon. So if we start on the left-hand side and we look at formula operating revenue, which was the smallest of those numerators, and we divide it by average daily membership weighted as defined by the state of Oregon, which was the largest of the denominators, In 2002, you came up with an answer of a little bit more than $5,000 per student, with not a lot of growth between 91 and 2002. That increased from 4,100 to about 5,000. Those are in nominal terms, are not inflation adjusted at this point. If we move to the other end of the chart, and then I'll talk about the middle, if you take the highest number for the numerator, total expenditures, which included the capital spending for buildings and remodelings, etc., and you divide it by the smallest student measure, which was the average daily attendance, because that's only counting the students if they actually show up in the building that day, then you can get a number that that exceeds $10,000. So you've almost got a doubling if you go from one measure to the other. Again, I emphasize here that both of those measures are accurate and are, assuming that over time you are comparing the same measure to itself, are perfectly valid measures. So I would urge you as policymakers and as interested people in Oregon education that when people come forward and tell you something about spending in Oregon, that you push back at them and say, okay, what is your measure? And have you been consistent over time? Again, in the middle are statistics that are probably better suited to compare across states because they are ones that are more commonly reported, and according to the National Center on Education Statistics, have student measures that are more consistently calculated across states. In particular, the current expenditures per fall enrollee, where we show growth between 91 and 2002 from roughly 5,155 to 7,856. That is the series, that is the, those were the statistics that were reported by the Oregonian in April of 2002 that showed that Oregon spending a little bit more than the national average and more than our Western neighbors. Any questions about this particular slide?
Mr. Chair.
Yes.
Again, I'm doing this arithmetic very roughly and quickly in my head, but it looks to me like the differences on the left end between 91 and 2002 are roughly somewhere between 20 and 25%, which, of course, is less than the inflation rate, whereas on the far end, the total expenditures per ADA, the difference is about 60% almost between 91 and 2002. Do we have any idea what we would attribute that difference to?
Let's.
You're going to get to that.
We're going to get to that.
Thank you.
Okay. Let's see. So then the question that policymakers and others typically raise is, has spending kept pace with inflation? And what might explain the differences in growth rates in different spending per student measures? So there's a lot of numbers on this chart, and I want to bite them off one at a time. So let's just take a look at the top panel. Rather than frequently analysts will come forward, and they will come forward with the answer and say, here's spending per student, and it's adjusted for inflation, and see how the number goes down, and so spending hasn't kept pace with inflation. In this chart, what we attempted to do is to simply put the statistics out there and let you make your informed decision on whether spending has kept pace with inflation or not. Like spending per student calculations, there are also different measures of inflation. And here we report four different measures over the course of the 1990s. The first fairly common one that's used throughout the country is the Consumer Price Index for urban consumers. This is the total growth between 1991 and 2001. That particular index increased 30% over the course of the decade. If we look more specifically, the U.S. Bureau Bureau of Labor Statistics also calculates a CPI for the Portland-Salem area, the metropolitan area that combines Portland and Salem, and that one grew a little bit more quickly than the national one. So that one increased about 36.4% over the course of the decade. Another relevant statistic would be what has happened to wages in general in Oregon. And I say that is relevant because education is a highly labor-intensive activity. And roughly 80 to 85% of all costs in education are labor-related on salaries and benefits, very little of it being on supplies and building materials, et cetera. So what has happened to the wages of other laborers in Oregon? And there you can see that the average wage per job in Oregon over that period increased about 54.4%. Now that, I would emphasize, is a statewide average, and not every part of the state enjoyed that type of wage growth. A fair amount of that wage growth was driven by the rapid increase in the high-tech sector, which largely benefited the Willamette Valley. But nonetheless, if you take a statewide average, that's what you come up with. Then the final statistic, and this is also a national one, and it's not available locally, also developed by the Bureau of Labor Statistics, is what is the growth in private school elementary and high school tuition and fees during the 1990s. So the question here would be, did Oregon spending sort of outpace, or spending per student outpace, the growth that was being charged by private schools? And there you can see there was very high growth, at least measured by Bureau of Labor Statistics over the course of the decade, 88.4%. So those are four candidate inflation indices. Now let's turn to the per student spending measures, which are the bottom panel. And this gets to your questions, Representative Barnhart. The first one, formula operating revenue per ADMW, that particular spending per student figure grew only 20.6% over the course of the decade. And why was that? If you recall that numerator, the blue line back on formula operating revenue, that was the sort of the slowest growing of those three statistics that I showed, in part because formula operating revenue coming out of Salem and going to the districts was not as fast growing as other components, federal spending that was coming into the state and some local option money and other local expenditures that in the beginning of the decade were virtually non-existent by the end of the decade had appeared. Probably even more the case is the denominator, the average daily membership weighted. You have a denominator that grew by 114,000 students compared to roughly 66,000 students if you use the traditional headcount measures. And that is driven by the classification or the increasing classification of students for special education, the influx of students with English learning needs, and other categories that get that special weight. So that student measure was by far and away the fastest growing of the student measures. If we look at formula operating revenue, but we drop the weighted piece and we look at average daily membership resident, then we see we're still one of the slowest growing measures there at 27.6%. So that sort of explains the amount that the weighting aspect in the students is adding to that. So you're up to 27.6, but you still haven't cracked the U.S. CPI at that point. You're still growing more slowly than the U.S. Consumer Price Index. Then if we move to the more traditional or nationally calculated current expenditure statistics, and there are three of those that I report there, which includes the federal money, it would include the local, it would include the state grants that don't go through the formula, it would include child nutrition money, and it would include local money that doesn't go through the formula, then you see growth rates in the 46% to 48% range, faster than the traditional measures of inflation, the CPI measures, but not as fast as wage growth in Oregon. It's sort of between those two. And then finally, if you looked at total expenditures per average daily membership, you get a growth of about 54%, which is right at roughly the average wage growth in Oregon. Any questions on that one? So the key findings on that first question, spending per student, is obviously spending per student can be defined in a wide number of ways, and that the findings on levels and growth vary widely depending on the definition used. And so again, I would urge you, when you read a report or when someone comes to testify on education spending, to be careful to understand precisely what they are telling you and which measure they're using.
Representative Scott?
Question for you. If I take the percentage growth in student measurements from 01 to 02, and if you take the category of ADMWs and use that all the way, and then you take the spending, I get, these are rough figures, but from a 13% increase to a weighted of 17.5% increase, and these are rough, so they're not exact. And then if you take it to your last, this chart, why do the statistical numbers not seem to track, and do they have any correlation in it, or am I going someplace I shouldn't go?
Can you describe the...
Okay, if you take page 27... and you take the ADMW, it appears to me that the growth, if you go back a couple of your slides, I believe that number was like 114,000.
Correct, the growth.
And then if you compare that, and I think that's somewhere in the neighborhood of a 17 or 18% increase from for the 10-year period of time.
Right.
Decade. If you compare that to the, I believe it was the residents, it was roughly a 13% growth, 68,000, if memory serves me. If you compare that to the spending per student measures
on page 28,
on page 28, you don't have the same percentage growth, and then you take it over to this last one, and I'm looking at and wondering why are the percentages so far off? And maybe it doesn't have any correlation. I'm just curious.
Well, you do have. You're focusing on the growth in the denominator with the spending figures, but we also have different growth rates for the numerators on the spending side. And so we're, in essence, what you are combining with the formula operating revenue per ADMW is the slowest growing spending statistic.
The dollars are the same, though.
The dollars?
Well, the amount that is spent would be the same.
On formula operating revenue, correct.
Yeah.
That, in essence, what's driving these statistics and producing the small, the smallest growth is the combination of the slowest growing revenue or spending figure in the numerator with the fastest growing student statistic in the denominator, and that together generates the 20.6, in essence.
I thought I did that by comparing it back with the smallest, and I thought statistically they should come out equal, but I couldn't get it to do that. So maybe I'm doing something
okay,
that wouldn't work.
Perhaps after
after
this we could sit down and
thank you.
I'd be more than happy to try to clarify that for you. So now addressing the second question, which is how does Oregon's per student spending compare to that of other states? And again, as I started this presentation, I started with sort of another question, is can you compare spending figures across states, and if so, with what caveats? We did contact the National Center on Education Statistics and spoke with the person who produces the national report and posed that question. How comparable are the figures that are submitted by different states? And this goes back to some of your concerns in terms of you're thinking of 51 different individuals submitting information, albeit reading the same directions, may not be submitting precisely the same information on spending or numbers of students, et cetera. The answer back from the National Center on Education Statistics is that in the early 1990s, and actually preceding that a little bit, in the late 1980s, they made a very aggressive effort to do outreach and technical assistance to states to the greatest extent possible, ensure that that the people who were filling out these forms and submitting the information were doing it in a roughly, well, more than roughly, hopefully precisely comparable way. That said, there is always going to be potential room for error there, and while the National Center for Education Statistics has definitely come forward and said you should be comfortable comparing statistics across states, as this report has come out, we continue to have folks that are concerned that there are differences. So I will say the National Center on Education Statistics has given its stamp of approval to such comparisons, but that we may go a little bit further in this report and dig a little bit deeper to understand what remaining differences exist, if any. So with that caveat, here are here are some comparisons again, and I'm moving to the middle of our of those statistics. If you think of that one chart that had all of the different measures with the we're picking one out of the middle, the current expenditures per fall enrollee, current expenditures, one that is again, the operations and maintenance doesn't include the capital outlays, and then per fall enrollee is that one snapshot in terms of the number of students. Here you can see that compared to the U.S. average, in 1991, Oregon was about 6% higher. We then slid down in, and by 96, 97 had virtually, well, we were within $3 of the national average. Then, in the latter part of the decade, helped in part by some local revenues and also state lottery funds that were distributed outside of the formula, bumped ourselves back above the average by 4 or 5% and up to the 2000-2001 school year. Now, another way to look at this is to compare current expenditures as a percent of total personal income in the state. So if you think, okay, what are we spending on operations and maintenance of our schools as a percent of sort of all the money that's available to the state? This is all the personal income generated by Oregonians or their counterparts in other states. And this tells a similar story to the previous chart, but displayed a little bit differently. You can see Oregon in 1991 was at 4.6% relative to a U.S. average of 4.1%, U.S. being way on the other side. Then by 96-97, which was sort of the point that I mentioned we were virtually identical, we're at 4.1% versus the U.S. average of 4. And then by 2000-2001, we were at 4.2 and the U.S. average of 3.9. So that gap between Oregon and the U.S. over the course of the decade narrowed a little bit. We were about a half of a percentage point different at the beginning of the decade. Now we're about 3/10 of a percentage point. You can see that relative to our peers in California and Washington, we spend devote a measurably higher share of our personal income to K through 12 current expenditures. Interestingly, Idaho, which is, if you just simply look at base statistics, appears to be a low-spending state. They spend considerably less per student than Oregon does, but it's driven in large part because they don't have a lot of personal income to spend on schools. They spend about the same share of their total available resources on K through 12 as Oregon does. So those were taking those statistics completely rolled up and comparing them at the highest level. We can also take statistics and take that total spending per student figure and chop it up in a number of different accounting ways and try to understand, okay, well, if we spend a little bit more than the federal than the U.S. average, on what is it that we spend a little bit more or less? And this is this analysis, which breaks the spending into, and I apologize for these terms because they're accounting, they're sort of sterile accounting terms, but objects and functions. Objects are salaries, benefits, purchase services, and supplies, and functions are the types of things that you are doing in the school: instruction, student and staff support, administration, operation and maintenance, and other support. Now, in each of these analyses that follows, we're taking the same total of roughly $7,200 in Oregon and cutting it up first by objects, and then taking the same $7,200 roughly, and this is a 99-2000 school year, which is the latest one that we can do this, taking the same roughly $7,200 and then cutting it up by object. So it's in both cases, we're looking at the total spending per student and chopping it up in different ways. First on objects.
Yes.
Before you get too complicated,
okay.
The $7,200 was...
$7,200 is current expenditures per fall enrollee in 1999-2000, which is the...
Okay, got it. I'm looking at 2001. Got it.
Right. And the back one. I apologize
for
that.
Thank you.
And that's the number you're using now to compare us with the national average.
So you...
Correct. And other states.
Yeah.
Right.
Okay. Thank you.
And that's the most recent year that NCSC sent out all of this detail so that you could chop it up. Now, the Secretary of State's audit report used the very same statistics to do a similar analysis. They didn't present it exactly the same way. But the answers are you can go into the Secretary of State's audit report and you get precisely the same. You know, they're within nickels. So there is no difference between that audit report and these statistics that we're presenting here. So first on objects, and this one lends itself to a bar chart because there are a few objects to compare. But this is, in essence, what we've done on this bar chart is take Oregon's level and then subtract the jurisdiction that we're comparing to, be it the nation or the neighboring state. So these are differences in essence. So let's start with the U.S. And we'll start with the bottom bar and work up. What this is saying is that we are spending on a per student basis between $300 and $400 less per student on salaries. And but that is more than offset by higher spending per student on benefits, which is that maroon bar. We also spend about $200 more per student on purchase services, which could be consulting services or services of medical staff that aren't permanent employees of a district, or lawyers, if lawyers have to be hired by school districts for legal issues and the like.
John, if you have a district that contracts out for transportation or custodial, those come under purchased services?
It could be, yes. Those certain items could fall under different categories depending on how they are paid for. For example, and I'm not absolutely sure this is the case, but Portland's well-publicized contracting out of janitorial services. Right. might fall under purchase services rather than salaries and benefits because they're not direct.
But not in these figures because that just occurred in this last year.
Yeah. Right. And then we spend a little bit less on supplies, tuition, and other. That statistic is largely supplies. There's very little going on in the way of tuition. So if you added those bars up, memory serves, I believe we were roughly $200 to $300 above the national average in the year that we're making that comparison. You added up to all those bars, that comes to that figure, that difference of $200 to $300 difference. So higher on benefits, less on salaries, higher on purchase services, and pretty close on supplies. Then if we look at the comparison states, obviously on benefits we do stand out. And this is, again, we're looking at about $400 to $500 more per student on benefits than the neighboring states. And this is before, this is sort of the, before the PERS blow up. This is 1999 to 2000, and before the employers' rates obviously went up largely this year. They went up a little bit last year as well.
But PERS is in that.
But PERS is in this statistic. And purchase services also higher than in California, Washington, and Idaho. Obviously, everything is higher than Idaho. We spend about $1,800 more per student than Idaho. So all of the statistics are higher there.
John, if I can ask, would administration be spread out across the bar charts there, or
correct,
administration in any one of those in particular?
You'll see administration in the next chart.
Okay,
when we break it out by function.
Yeah, okay, that's right.
But it's sprinkled in all of this. So the salaries of administrators are sprinkled in with the salaries of teachers, et cetera. Now, I apologize. I don't like putting as many numbers on a chart as this one has, but I've tried to highlight the ones that we want to pay attention to. First, actually, the ones that aren't highlighted, just to draw your attention to the very bottom of this chart. Again, that's total current expenditures, and so those figures along the bottom are the total difference between Oregon and the place that we're comparing it to. So, for example, relative to the United States, in 99-00, we were spending $238 per student more than the U.S. average. Compared to California, $834 more, Washington, $773, and Idaho, $1,834. Again, that's consistent with the previous chart as well. And then these numbers in the columns add up to that total. So there's some things that we spend a little bit less on, some things we spend a little bit more on, but then it adds up to that total. The ones that, the items that stand out, obviously, instruction relative to our neighboring states, we spend quite a bit more on instruction, $297 more than California, $441 than Washington, and $964, so about half of that difference with Idaho is in instructional expenditures. Then a lot of differences here and there that don't tell particularly consistent stories, where in some states we're spending more, quite a bit more, and less, but one consistent story is on other support services, where relative to the U.S. we're spending $193 more, California $130, Washington $214, and Idaho $309, and those other support services are sort of central business office operations. So it would be the payroll manager, the business office. Payroll production. It would also include, not transportation. It would include evaluations and research as well. So those, and those are all detailed in this report as well in terms of precisely what is in that category.
So, John, just to clarify from my mind, functions like payroll, those come under other support and not under general administration.
Yes. I mean, this is for other support services. I'll go ahead and read out of the report. So the chief business officer, fiscal services, budgeting, payroll, financial accounting, internal auditing, purchasing, warehousing, printing, and duplicating staff, It also captures central support staff involving planning, research, development, evaluation, and data processing.
Mr. Chair.
Yes.
Is it, I'm assuming that other states bury some of those costs in other categories on this chart.
Again, that would be, you know, the work of the National Center on Education Statistics, and attempting to get every state to report these statistics in the same way, would have tried to ferret that out to the best of their abilities. But I'm confident that given you've got multiple districts reporting to a state and multiple states reporting to the national government, that there's going to be differences in where things are reported.
Because, yeah, if we look at general administration and other support services, where we differ the greatest is it kind of offsets each other a little bit. Looking at California, for instance, we're 75
right.
over in GA, but only 130 over in other support.
Right. And certainly this report to this point has taken this analysis to this level and no further. It would certainly be of interest to explore that line in more detail at individual districts and at the state level to understand what those costs are more precisely and why those numbers are different than those in other states.
Thank you.
Well,
is there a bar?
I'm wondering if this suggests that we could improve our costs by looking hard at some of these things that are included in the other support services. I mean, your report probably doesn't get us to that question, does it?
No.
Okay,
thank you.
That's all. Yeah.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Barnhart, I might mention that several years ago, Oregon, in effect, mandated to school districts a uniform chart of accounts.
Yes.
And the Department of Education has done quite a bit of work to assure that when school districts report to the state, they report expenditures all in the boxes, the various boxes of objects and functions. So I think if you want to compare one Oregon school district with another, we have much better data for Oregon with the database initiative and that uniform chart of accounts than is really available at the state, or excuse me, at the national level.
So the key findings on the cross-state comparisons were during the 1990s, K through 12, current expenditures fell as a share of total personal income, but still exceeded the U.S. average by the end of the decade. That's an open question if you come back in a year or two whether that will still be the case. Second, spending on benefits per student exceeds the U.S. average and levels in neighboring states. And salaries per student are on par with California and Washington.
John, before you leave that, I guess, because we know the world has changed since your last audited year here. Do you, in putting this together, or even since then, did you come across any anecdotal evidence? I mean, are other states falling at the same rate that we are, the national average falling at the same rate, so that we're roughly consistent with these other states because we're all in the same trend?
Right.
Anything? I know we won't know for another couple of years
right.
where we are today, but do you have any good guess from the information you've seen as to how we might look?
My sense is, speaking with both through the popular press and with speaking with folks in other states, is that Oregon's fiscal condition in general is worse than the average.
But we haven't. But at the same time, we haven't applied the level of cuts to school spending as we
right.
have to other programs, and so
exactly. So it will be precisely what you said. To know for sure what is going to happen, we will not for a year or two. There is one statistic here, though, that I know Brian Reeder at the Department of Education has made a rough estimate at. And it's the spending as a percent of total personal income. It is his estimate that if you had sort of expected growth in federal in federal spending and then other local expenditures, that statistic that was 4.2% in the 2000-2001 school year could fall as low as 3.7% for the 2002-03 school year. Mm-hmm. So that's a pretty... I haven't attempted to independently verify that figure, but his estimate is that it could go as low as 3.7%.
But again, that would be more meaningful if we also knew where California, Washington, and the U.S. average was.
Exactly. And there I can't.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, maybe on the USDA website, which is not.
So the final aspect of the study were 16 district case studies. The Oregon School Boards Association recognized at the beginning of this study that the school finance picture was going to differ considerably depending on where you sat in the state, given equalization and given different demographic growth trends in the state. And so they selected 16 districts that they wanted us to both review the detailed financial statistics for, and then also interview three high-level officials in each of those districts. And the high-level officials, if they were available, were typically the superintendent, a school board member, and a business office individual, somebody who would be able to speak to accounting and the statistics. That didn't always work out in each of the 16 districts, but it did for a large number of them. When we looked at their statistics, and again, I apologize, I'll try to help you digest this chart, which has a lot of numbers on it as well. These are the 16 districts that we looked at. They ranged in sizes, Burns being one of the smaller of the districts, Beaverton, Salem, David Douglas being larger districts, but then also had sort of obviously had an urban and rural mix to them as well. They also varied to the degree that they had relatively strong local revenue bases pre-Measure 5 to weak local revenue bases post-Measure 5, and so they benefited in different degrees vis-a-vis the equalization process. These districts are ordered, actually, by our calculation of their local revenue per student in 1991. So the districts that seem to show higher local revenues per student are at the top of this, and the ones that had lower local revenue per student are at the bottom. That explains the ordering there. If we look at the first column is a calculation of current expenditures per ADMR. Not ADMW, and we put ADMR because it was in the state's accounting. It was a statistic that was easily grabbed for no other reason. It was reported in the accounting statistics, but it is not a weighted figure. So it is sort of the operation and maintenance per ADMR and the change between 1991 and 2001. And so that's a 10-year change, and think back to those inflation statistics that we had on the CPI and the average wages in Oregon, et cetera. Those were also 10-year changes. So this is a total change in current expenditures per ADMR, and I have bolded the ones there that did not keep pace with the Portland-Salem CPI, which is, I simply picked one. Might want to redo it and do it for the national CPI, but in any event, that's what you're looking at. And so this first column is showing you that in four of those 16 districts that current expenditures per ADMR did not keep pace with the rate of inflation as measured in the Portland-Salem metropolitan area, but that you had that obviously others did and exceeded it. The rates of increase tend to get a little bit larger toward the bottom of the chart, which is simply a function of equalization. They were starting with a very low revenue base, local revenue base in the beginning, benefited from equalization over the course of the decade, and therefore have somewhat stronger growth. Then we break, the next two columns break those current expenditures into and look at instructional spending and break that into spending, and these are accounting terms, on regular education instruction, which are your main math and reading and social studies programs, etc., versus special education instruction, which is, it's not only what a lot of people think of as special education for students with physical or mental disabilities, but also includes English learning students, it includes Title I students, it includes students at risk of dropping out, etc. So here we're looking at the rate of change in spending per student in those categories, and you can see under regular education instruction that in 10 of the 16 districts that the spending on regular education instruction per ABMR did not keep pace with the Portland-Salem Consumer Price Index. And in the six that it did, for example, Phoenix Talent, David Douglas, Lakeview, et cetera, it was just sort of just right above that 36% for Portland-Salem. So despite the fact that the majority of districts saw current expenditures per ADMR keep pace with that traditional measure of inflation, that regular instruction per ADMR was not keeping pace with inflation. Then you look at special instruction per ADMR, and there you see some pretty dramatic increases. Virtually all of them exceed or approach 100%. So spend 100% would be a doubling in spending per student on special instruction for ADMR. And you even have some as high as 300% in Burns. So in essence, what was happening is that for roughly 10-15% of the population, districts were spending more per student, and that would be manifested by English learning classes being offered throughout the district as opposed to centralized classes, and individual learning programs being offered to students with disabilities, etc. A lot more resources being devoted to 10-15% of the population, and the remaining roughly 85% of the population was in some districts seeing a bit of an erosion in terms of real spending on the more mainstream activities of math, social studies, etc. So that certainly was borne out by these statistics. It also came through in the interviews that we had that I mentioned with the superintendents, etc.
John, before you go on that, I'm just curious. How were the fixed costs broken out between regular and special? That is, costs that weren't necessarily allocable to one or the other. Administration?
Well, the support services are outside of instruction completely.
Oh, these are just instructional dollars?
These are instructional dollars.
Okay.
And then, obviously, there are no capital
Good enough.
In there as well.
Now, if I may, Mr. Chair.
Yes.
I'm just looking at the list, and I may have missed it a little bit, but if you added Beaverton and Salem-Keizer together, in terms of the number of students they have, they would equal more than all of the other districts combined.
I haven't attempted that particular...
Yeah. I mean, just doing this in my head quickly.
Yeah. Right.
But, I mean, I think if you're trying to weight this chart based on the number of affected people, you can compare those two districts to everything else, and you're
right.
You're
but again, these
or more.
These 16 districts are literally case studies. We didn't try.
Right.
We tried to get a mix. It wasn't sort of a scientific selection.
Right. No, I understand that, and that's fine. Yeah. Thank you.
But let me back up and say that there is a chart in this report, and we can move back to it, that this phenomenon took place statewide. Luckily, get 16 districts, or sort of by chance get 16 districts that had a large increase in special education instruction. If you look at a statewide figures rolled up and those particular accounting codes, this trend bears out across the state.
Yes, Representative Hobson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Would that phenomenon also be apparent in California, Washington, and Idaho?
I could only speculate. I haven't looked. I didn't drill down sort of within the numbers in or taking that cut in those neighboring states. I would be surprised if it didn't, if they weren't facing the same types of issues, because in essence what the districts were telling us is that there was a certainly on this with respect to students with physical and mental disabilities, that there is a trend toward increasing legal activity and the involvement of lawyers in terms of pressing for additional services for their students that they saw that they were eligible for under federal law, and that trend is not specific only to Oregon.
If I could add a little bit there, Representative Hobson, I think if you look at the growth in Hispanic students, for example, over the last decade in Oregon, it's been significant. Mm-hmm. And now the question is whether or not that same level of growth has occurred in California that started off with a high level of Hispanic students. And I would guess that Washington or Oregon compares more closely with Washington, perhaps to a different extent than Idaho. And second, as you know from the work that you did on the Special Education Task Force, there's been a significant growth in the number of autistic students. And I would guess that growth is probably similar to other states given diagnostic techniques and so forth. So there may be some differences. There may be something in common with those other states.
Well, John's point is a good one. On the languages, while California is going to always dominate us in terms of the level or the share of students that speak other languages, the change in Oregon over the course of the 90s was higher in Oregon than in California. And in terms of the diversity of languages spoken, which also has an impact on budgets, in Portland, with which I'm most familiar, you've got Russian and Vietnamese with a much larger presence than it had in the early 1990s. And that costs districts as well.
But John, would those costs related to ESL be reflected in the special education column, or are those?
Yes, those are.
It's not just special ed in the way that we think of students under IEPs. This would also encompass then ESL students.
Correct. The way that we have reported this statistic includes English learning students as well.
Mr. Chair.
Yes.
I would assume then that some of the students who are included in special education in 2001, in 1991, students with the same characteristics would have been included in regular education because of a shift in definitions or a shift in categorizing.
Yeah. Would be my understanding.
Seems like they would have been one or the other.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Right. That students with similar characteristics may have not been provided services
correct
that qualified as special education.
Yeah, that was my point. Thank you very
right
much.
Yeah. So when asked to think about those statistics, I mean, those are numbers and not terribly interesting, and so we tried to get underneath those numbers and get a sense of how those trends affect districts on a year-to-year basis. This is what we heard back from those administrators, again, typically superintendents, school board members, and business office individuals, that the loss or that slight erosion in real terms on the regular education side, if it happened in a district, it typically came at the expense of music programs, of foreign languages, of sports, of outdoor school programs, et cetera. Those were the types of programs that were most frequently mentioned as the first to go when times got tight. And it was very different depending on where you were in the state. If you're in Burns and you only have 17 high school students to begin with, and your regular education instruction dollars are being squeezed and you have to eliminate a teacher, you might be eliminating an entire program with that teacher. If you're in an urban area and you have many more teachers, you might be eliminating French 3 or... But the impacts in very small districts, because obviously they have such a limited number of teachers in some of their schools, can result in the loss of entire programs. The second point was that the cap on health insurance had helped keep benefit growth in check in the late 1990s. We didn't see over the course of the 1990s a large increase. While Oregon spent more on benefits per student on average, we didn't see that number increasing a lot in those districts over the course of the 1990s. They spent a lot in the early, or not a lot, but they spent more on average in the early 1990s, more on average in the late 1990s, but not tremendous growth in that statistic. And health insurance caps were cited as one policy vehicle that helped that benefit growth stay in check. And then, as I mentioned early on, districts had yet to experience the strong growth in the PERS contributions. They were expecting them this year, but up to the point that I interviewed them in May of last year, in June, they hadn't seen them yet.
Well, I would say, too, we hadn't gotten to the spike in health insurance costs either in this, so I would imagine that benefits piece just ought to be off the chart by about now.
Right. So the overall conclusions of the study are these. First, a single statewide spending estimate is going to miss a lot of important complexities. Obviously, you've got the equalization process going on, so you've got 198 districts out there that are looking at the world differently. And are benefiting or benefited over the course of the 90s in different ways from the change in the way that we pay for schools. And then it also misses the complexity of changes in spending on regular instruction versus special instruction. The regular instruction and special instruction can give you a sense as to why, despite the fact overall spending, if you look at it in sort of those national statistics of current expenditures per fall enrollee, you could come forward and say we've kept pace with inflation and done a little bit better, but nonetheless a superintendent or a budget officer is feeling pinched in regular education because spending went up considerably per student for 15% of the population, but in many districts was eroded or didn't quite keep pace with inflation on regular instruction. Oregon's spending per student, the second point here, trended toward the U.S. average but remained above it by 2000-2001. And again, we're not at any point now to say where it's going to be in the next couple of years. Spending per student on employee benefits is above the national average and levels in neighboring states. And then finally, Oregon also shows higher spending per student on purchased services and other support services, so central payroll, evaluation, research activities, etc.
Mr. Chair.
Yes, Representative Barr.
In the conclusion, Oregon's spending per student on benefits is above the national average, and that is pre-PERS.
So that includes that in
pre-PERS
spike.
Yeah.
Correct. So if left unmitigated, which it doesn't appear that's going to be the case, but if you simply played out and attempted to increase employer rates to pay for the unfunded liability as it has been recently calculated by PERS, Oregon would, I'm confident in saying, Oregon would move even further away from the national average.
We can assume that other states are experiencing higher health costs, probably, but and I doubt that I've not read of any other state that's experiencing the same kind of retirement system costs that we've seen here in the last couple of years here in Oregon.
I think that is fair.
Mr. Chair, I had was curious about the employer contributions to retirement in other states. So about 6 months ago, I surveyed my counterparts in other states and got responses back from, I think, about 25. And the question that I posed was, what is the mandatory contribution that school districts in your state make to employee retirement? And what I found was that although there are anomalies in different states, that Oregon, at our current 12.3% contribution of payroll to public employees' retirement, was higher than every other state that responded to my survey, with the exception of Michigan and Ohio. And what was interesting, that employer contributions to retirement in many states are expenditures that are made at the state level. They're not considered as school district expenditures. Mm-hmm. In some states, there's some state contribution, some local contribution. In some states, there's one contribution that goes to licensed teachers. There's another contribution level that goes to a separate retirement program for school classified employees. But it stood out that our contribution was higher than those other two states, and I don't know to what extent that information is available, but I think it might be interesting and shed some light on the differences between Oregon and other states.
And that's a 12.3%, and we know we're headed up from there.
Well, it's 12.73 right now for school districts, and that does not include the 6% contribution that some school districts have bargained to pay on behalf of their employees.
Now, there is if you go to your report on page 3-9, this is not as up-to-date as Mr. Marshall's information, but this was a survey actually done by the American Federation of Teachers back in 97-98, and looked at the combined Social Security, Medicare, and in-state retirement contributions made by employers, and compares Oregon with neighboring states and to the U.S. average. And there you can see have you all located 3-9?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. That Oregon teachers participate fully in Social Security and Medicare, and therefore Oregon employers pay the 7.65%. California teachers do not fully benefit or participate in Social Security and Medicare, and therefore the state saves on that payroll item. Washington, Idaho do. The U.S. average is a little bit lower than the 7.65, probably because of California. And then if you look at state retirement, again, this was 97-98, so this is pretty outdated at this point, but the 15.8% recognizes that the typical employer share was between 9 and 10, and then a lot of districts were picking up the employee share as well. Then you can see the comparison districts, but in the total, Oregon's up at 23.45, California clear down at 10.85 when that statistic was calculated, and the U.S. average at 15.78. It would be nice to get this updated, but obviously, as you pointed out, with employer rates, you know, potentially the employer rates for getting the employee share forecast to increase to potentially 20% or more if PERS were not addressed, the gap between Oregon and the rest of the country would be even larger.
Is that it?
That's it.
Oh.
Unless, I'm certainly happy to answer any additional questions that you have.
Well, other questions? I mean, excellent report. You say it's kind of like sitting around the dining table in the dark of winter looking at the snapshot or the pictures from last summer's vacation. that was fun. That was fun. But still, I guess it helps to know where you've been in order to chart the course for where you're going. Representative Barnhart?
Thank you. I'm wondering if in the process of preparing this report, you were able to glean any of the differences, if there are any. It may simply be demographics, between, for example, Pleasant Hill and Redmond on one side and the other districts on the other in relation to the percent increase in special education costs. Those two districts were up about 45-46%. Everybody else was up much, much more than that. Of course, it may just be that they're small towns on the edge of things, but any idea why they were able to keep their costs increase so low and that everyone else's was so enormous in that category?
We didn't drill down to those individual districts and try to compare across them once we got those statistics in hand. Typically, though, the less urban is a district, the urban areas tend to attract, for example, foster care caseloads, SSI caseloads, et cetera, because there are medical services available to them in those urban areas. Likewise, students with English learning needs, because of the nature of labor markets, tend to end up in urban areas or in the Willamette Valley more likely than Burns or Pendleton. And so the growth and the issues with respect to special education appeared to be a little bit more robust and active in urban districts than in rural districts. But certainly that's not to say that rural districts were immune, because there is a sort of change of mindset. There are students that rural districts and urban districts had been treating all along that they are now treating differently, and they are giving more intensive services to than they would have 10 years ago. Another point made by school officials is that it is their belief that there are students, because of the medical advances, that wouldn't have survived 10 or 15 years ago that are surviving now and are being treated in the schools.
And Mr. Chairman, I hope that as you get into discussions of the distribution formula, and should that lead you into a desire for more information about school spending, that you will rely on the Department of Education. Over the last several years, we've made a significant investment in the Database Initiative Project, and that gives us all kinds of information by school and school district on a variety of spending. And you can certainly drill down and get answers to a variety of questions that you might have, and it's been a valuable resource, and I hope you'll use it.
Okay, anything else?
Mr. Chair.
Yes, Representative Farr.
I think, thank you for making that point, John, and it's going to be interesting to see how things have shifted over the last couple of years. Mr. Chair, you talked about last summer's vacation, looking at pictures in the middle of winter. I kind of equate it to looking at pictures of a great meal you had last week, but you're starving today. So the sooner we can get that information, the better off we're all going to be. Thank you.
All right. Well, it's a good foundation for things that we will have to be deciding and dealing with in this session. With that, I guess we will conclude the meeting today. Tomorrow we have on the agenda it's corporate tax, I think. Okay, I know you've all been, every member's been asking me, when are we going to get to corporate tax? When are we going to get to corporate tax? So the wait is over, folks. Tomorrow, corporate tax. 8:30, we will see you then. We're adjourned.
Thank you.